Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Alejandra Bronfman. My guest today is Diana McCauley. She's the author of a new book called Daylight Come, published by People Tree Press in 2020. Diana McCauley is a writer and environmental activist from Jamaica. This is her fifth novel, and as a work of speculative fiction, it looks into a future in which it is too hot to go outside during the daytime. This has implications for the ways island inhabitants live, work, and even love. McCauley sounds an alarm and creates a world that is not so distant from what many communities are already experiencing. Yet at the same time, her world is not without beauty or kindness. Here's our conversation. I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, Diana. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start by having you tell me a little bit about the origin story for this book. How did you get the idea for it?
It was several years ago now, and I was traveling in the UK. And I saw a story of construction workers in the Middle East. I think it was Qatar, but don't hold me to that. But somewhere in the Middle East, construction workers were falling from the scaffolding of buildings because of extreme heat. And it started me thinking about what would happen if it became too hot to go outside during the day. I mean, I live in Jamaica. I've lived here all my life, except for 2 years at school. And when I came home, I then started to really pay close attention to how much of our life occurs outside here in a Caribbean island. And of course, there's just an enormous amount of people who are working and living outdoors. And that was the sort of kernel of the novel. What happens if it's too hot to go outside? How would we respond to that? How would we grow food? You know, what kind of work would we have? What would happen to the things that we regard as the norm in Western societies? You know, things like roads and schools and all of that. And once the idea sort of took hold of me, I couldn't shake it. And that was the beginning of Daylight Come.
Yeah, so actually wanted to ask you about that. The circumstances in the book, as you mentioned a little bit, are quite dire, right? You can't be outside during the day. The roads have melted. Food and water are scarce. And it's practically unrecognizable. But at the same time, as you mentioned, and as I was just reading a story in the newspaper yesterday, a story about India, and the temperatures there are reaching 120 degrees, and they are warning agricultural laborers not to be outside. So it's not that far from what you're talking about. How many steps away do you think we are from that?
Well, that's a timing thing, and you know, I don't know, and I don't want to predict. All I know is the risks of these kinds of scenarios increase every day that we don't act in the way that we should. And I don't mean individuals. I have come to feel that the climate crisis is a large geopolitical problem, a problem of leadership, a problem of governments. And they seem very unwilling to take the kind of drastic action that's needed, which I totally understand. I don't want my entire life, you know, upturned either. So I basically think these outcomes are ahead of us in some unknown time frame, which is affected by how we choose to act. But for Jamaica, it's not at all far off that we might have food shortages, or it might become too hot to go outside during the day, or even that our existing shelters, our homes, which are often built with a completely different temperature in mind, become very difficult to live in. And in writing the book, I also tried to include things that had actually happened already in some part of the world. So they haven't, of course, all happened on one island, but almost everything in the book has occurred in some place at some time in the world.
Yeah, I found that to be true. So things were recognizable, not completely foreign or alien. But you've been working on these issues for a long time, right? You created the Environmental Foundation, Jamaica Environmental Trust, a while ago. And I'm wondering how that has shaped your writing, and also vice versa, how the writing has shaped the environmental work that the trust does.
They're very closely related. My Daylight Come is my first sort of explicitly environmental book, if I could call it that. But if my other books have this very, I hope anyway, this very strong connection to an foundation in place, because for me, that is a very important aspect of being human that we ignore at our peril. So it was my own connection to place that led me into environmental work more than 30 years ago now. And then because writing is a way I try and make sense of the world, even figure out sometimes what I think. And because I also think stories are the best way to communicate with other human beings, people you will never meet, don't know, you know, live in a completely different part of the world, have totally different experiences to you. I translate these concerns that I have that only increased during my years as an environmental activist into my writing.
So how did you decide that a 14-year-old girl was going to be the protagonist?
I'm a little obsessed. There's something, if you read my books, I'm obsessed with certain things. So I'm obsessed with place. I'm obsessed with naming. And I'm obsessed with that age person where, you know, you're on the cusp of teenage, maybe just post puberty, beginning to grapple with what it means to be a woman or a man, because I've written also about 12-year-old, one of my protagonists is a 12-year-old boy. So I'm interested in that period of both girls' and boys' lives, young women and young men's lives. It's something I remember very clearly in my own life, although I'm, you know, decades away from that time. And I just think it's full of drama, and it's full of trying to figure out the world and your place in it.
Yeah, and she really, Sorrel is her name, and you can really sort of watch her trying to do that. I was really interested in the way that she related to the world, right? She lives in a very difficult world. Her circumstances are quite dire, and she has wisps of memories of things of how it was before, but she still manages to find joy and beauty and kind of comfort where she can, and she feels a lot of empathy and she has hope, right? And so I'm wondering why that was important to you.
So I've read very widely. I'm a voracious reader, as so many writers are. I've read very widely about people in these dreadful situations, you know, Holocaust, wars, genocides, aftermath of genocides, natural disasters. And I've been struck by that. I've been struck by how even in the most dire circumstances, people whose, you know, lives are absolutely on the line, they have no comfort, they have no agency, they're being ruled over by arbitrary and cruel people, they still find a way to find hope. They still notice beauty. They still look out for each other. And that's what I wanted to write about. I wanted to write about not just what would happen to the physical world, not just what would happen to our conduct of our lives, but how would we feel? How would we react? Would we look after each other? Would we become, you know, just feral as some of the animals in the book do? Would we see hope? And would we walk towards that hope, you know, try and seek out a better life? Or would we just give up? And so I didn't want my protagonist to give up. I wanted her to instinctively know that this was not the way human beings were supposed to live, and really try to find a better way.
Yeah. And the relationship with her mother is really important in the book, too. And I noticed that actually you chose to write in the first person when you write in the mother's voice. And why did you make that choice?
I struggle quite a bit with point of view, and I often go through my books changing them. But I wanted to give the mother, I wanted to give her a chance to explain, to talk directly to the reader about her own experiences, because she's the one who has seen the change, you know, more the grandmother who is dead, but the mother is the one who can explain what's really happened. And so that's why it was important for me to have her say it directly rather than a narrator in the third person.
Yeah. I was interested also in the mother because, you know, as a mother and as a university professor, I spend my life surrounded by young people, right? And so there's a kind of current of real animosity and hatred towards older people in this book, almost institutionalized, right? And they're to blame for the world as it is. And I often tell my students, you know, you have to fix this mess that we've made here. Maybe it's a little bit different from your experiences in Jamaica now, but in the book, it's really striking that elders are not respected. They're ostracized. They're left out to die. How did you come to realize that that was going to shape the story?
It just seemed to me that's that logical thing that could happen and maybe will happen, because it's my generation and, you know, a little bit younger than me now who are really still mired in inaction. And so I can really imagine younger people. I have two grandnephews who are both under two. And I often, when I go to visit them, I want to apologize to them, you know. I want to say, I'm really sorry. I tried, personally, you know, but a whole bunch of us have left you to deal with this, with this mess. And so I thought it was quite likely that given the kind of societal breakdown that I describe, that they'd be a cast around for someone to blame. There always is, you know. And that it was very likely going to fall on old people. And then there would be this idea that, you know, their resources are now scarce. There's not enough food. There's not enough water. Shelter is a problem. So who's expendable? And who can we justify as being expendable? And it seemed to me it would definitely be old people.
Yeah. Except they have a little bit of knowledge.
Yes, but I think what I imagined was the young people would feel, what good was your knowledge? It didn't lead you to act. You knew and you chose to do nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. In that sense, I mean, I think that really resonates with the ways that I feel quite often, actually. It's true. So can we talk about hair? There's a theme in the book about hair, short hair, growing hair. I'm very curious as to how you think about hair and why it plays such a role in the book.
But it's related to another thing that I often get asked about, which is race, right? Skin color. So the emphasis on hair and skin color is, or rather the lack of emphasis on skin color, the lack of discussion of it, is a sort of reflection of preoccupations of current Jamaican culture. I mean, right now, as I'm writing, as I'm speaking to you, there's an enormous debate over some teenage boys who were excluded from their school because their hair didn't meet grooming standards. So, you know, all these years after colonialism and British rule, we're still very conflicted about hair. So I wanted to talk about how hair was seen. Was it still a preoccupation? And I imagine that it was, you know, that it differentiated people. And I wanted to signal as well, by using hair without explicitly saying what colored people were really, that there was this very mixed racially, these ideas of black and white, these binaries of black and white, which is how we tend to talk about skin color, had disappeared. And I wanted to signal that a bit by the way people had different kinds of hair. And in a way, when the question of, so everybody has to have their hair taken off, right? Because this is a command of the government called the Domins. I wanted to suggest that this is a way to control people, to make them the same, to take away their individuality. And it was only when the group of tribals were out of the control of the government that they were able to express some of that individuality. And they were allowed to have whatever hair they had, if you see what I mean.
Yes, absolutely. And that actually answers a question that I had about race, because I read the book and I realized that you don't talk about it at all, which is a little bit unusual, but it works just beautifully in the book. So it's very interesting. And the question of hair, yes, comes up a lot, I think, in any of those contexts, in terms of also in just in terms of youth and how, you know, our sort of older people's expectations for them about grooming, as you said.
Right. Yeah. And I thought, you know, I wondered, again, trying to, you know, world build and imagine this world. I wondered if every aspect of our lives was under threat or destroyed, and we were really clinging to a rather bleak survival, if race would remain a preoccupation for us. And I decided to imagine that it wouldn't. And I decided to imagine a world where there had been enough intermarriage that the skin color idea had become just these shades, you know, these shades of different colors and not the binary that we tend to talk about, even though that binary is also completely untrue if you really look at people,
mm-hmm.
you know. Yeah. So that's what I was trying to get at, that things have become so dire that our old preoccupations, the old ways that we divided ourselves from each other, had become irrelevant.
Yeah. But gender still matters.
Gender still matters. Yes, gender still matters. And again, you know, these are choices you make. You can't write about every possible thing in any novel. But I did want to write about relationships between women, which is why there's a strong element of the relationship between Sorrel and her mother, the relationship between her mother and her grandmother, and the relationship between the women, the tribals that live together in a band. And I wanted to talk a bit about what happens when they encounter men. Mm-hmm. That they've really in their lives had very, men or boys, and they've really in their lives had almost no interaction with the opposite sex because of the way that, you know, they're all working at home and everybody works at night and sleeps in the day. So I guess that was what I wanted to explore about the lives of women, the relationships between women, whether they support each other or fight against each other, and the, you know, how much a mother is prepared to sacrifice for her daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a tremendous sacrifice. But I mean, the thing that also struck me in the book is that there is there's some violence, there's some gender violence, right? There's some fear, and there's a whole sort of set of discourses about the differences between men and women. But then also in the end, there's a little bit of hope, right? It's not entirely dystopian.
Yes, I didn't want to leave you at the end of the book feeling when I just walk into the sea now, you know. And actually, thinking about it, I wanted to write two books, which is why the end, in a way, it leaves it open as to what happens when the people from the north arrive on the cruise ships, not to totally give away the end of the book. But there's a question about, well, what's really going to happen now? I mean, you know, there's been some, as you say, some hopes. They've found a place that maybe is possible. What happens next? Is the world going to leave them alone? If you live in a place like Jamaica, where we have some advantages where the climate crisis is concerned, you know, it's a hilly island. So although, yes, a lot of our coastal development is going to be badly affected by sea level rise and probably increased storms. We have mountains, you know, which will probably also help with the temperature, you know, the temperature problems, because as you go up, it's cooler. So we have some advantages. We have a year-round growing season. So I thought, well, is the world going to leave us alone? Let's say we figure it out here, you know, and we've carved out some kind of society, like going back to the Tainos, Jamaica's original inhabitants did. You know, probably lower populations, probably a very different way of life than what we have now. But suppose we figured it out and we're coping. Is the world going to leave us alone?
And so what's the second book you wanted to write?
Well, I'm not sure that I will do that, because actually after I completed this, I, you know, started writing something else, which is now almost finished. But that was my thinking to get into in the first book to get into what life was like on the island, and then in the second book to think about, well, how's the world going to react to this? You know, are we going to see what's happening in Ukraine to a degree? You know, where somebody else wants what you have and goes to take it, and or what happened in history? You know, with the original inhabitants here who were annihilated by the Spanish initially and then the English.
Yeah.
And you know, there's this also as well. What have Jamaicans done? You know, both slaves themselves and descendants of enslaved peoples. What have they done? They've escaped to the hills. There's this tradition of marronage. So I wanted to talk about that too. So this thing is occurring again in our history, and again at our hands, because the climate crisis is something we humans have caused.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you were talking about sort of the nature of Jamaica and the island and the importance of place. And I really sense that in the book. But I'm wondering also if this could be sort of more broadly a Caribbean book.
Yes, I think that, which is, you know, why I fictionalized Jamaica. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's recognizable to any Caribbean person living on a hilly island, which is many, if not most of them. And I think the problems that everyone faces on Bajaku are the problems that are going to come to the entire Caribbean region, which we seem to be quite blissfully thinking is way down, way ahead in the future, and is not.
Yeah. So I don't often interview writers of fiction. This is really fun for me. But I'm wondering how you think that historians or social scientists would benefit from reading and engaging your work.
Well, as I said, I think stories are the things that reach into people's hearts rather than their minds. My life as an environmental activist, so I retired in 2017, although my concerns haven't retired. In the early days, I made a very great effort to have the facts, you know. So I did a lot of research. I knew numbers. I could quote scientific studies. If I was concerned about something, but I didn't know much about it, I was unwilling to speak. But I eventually started to understand that my command of the facts wasn't what persuaded people. It was my any reach to their emotions. When I let my worry, my fear, my anger, my passion, my conviction, when I let that show, that was when I reached people. So I think there is a need for people who, social scientists, people who write nonfiction, and I must say I do see this a lot in some of the creative nonfiction that's coming out on climate and environment now. They have to also, while presenting whatever set of facts there are, they have to reach for people's hearts, and nothing does that better than stories. It gets people talking, you know. I mean, you're a teacher, professor. Imagine, you know, you take a scientific or textbook on climate into your classroom and ask for a discussion on what's in the book versus a story like this one. Or, I mean, I don't know if you've read Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry of the Future, which starts with this massive heat wave in India, which is, you know, happening right now as we speak. You get people talking with stories. And that seems to me now at this juncture that we're in, the most important thing that needs to happen. When you go out for your friend with your friends for a drink, the climate crisis is what needs to be the subject. You can imagine that makes me really popular and I don't get many invitations to go for a drink, but that's what I think.
Well, I mean, I agree. I do teach these both kinds of texts to my students, and inevitably, you know, they come away thinking and talking and wanting to read more of the novels and the fiction and the stories, because that's really what gets them and what they remember and what they connect with more than anything else, right? So absolutely. And sometimes I think we should just all give up and hand it over to the fiction writers.
I don't know about all give up, but I do think there's a very great place for creative people, not just writers, but all kinds of creative people, to really try and get us to understand what it is we are facing, what it is we have done.
Yeah. Without giving too much away, do you have a favorite passage in your book?
You know, I have a favorite passage in many other of my books that I can go to right away, but this one is harder. Let me look, I have it beside me. I think one of the places that I come back to over and over again is the voice of the mother when she talks about how this all happened. Mm-hmm. So do you want me to read it? Is that what you're asking?
I would love that. Yes. Thank you.
Okay. So this is Bibi, Sorrel's mother. Mm-hmm. They called it different things: change, then crisis, followed by emergency. Then they changed it to disruption, then disaster. In the end, it didn't matter. Finally, they, and you never knew who they were, realized that the worsening climate converged with poverty, geography, and history. So now they call it the convergence. I was 11 and lived with my parents in the foothills overlooking Bana. Higher elevations were cooler, so we were luckier than others, and I believed we deserved it. Every night, my mother and father watched good-looking men and women on television report on melting ice, swirling snowstorms, cities swallowed by earthquakes. We saw people washed away by rivers that broke their banks, taking villages with them. We watched whole islands drown. All this was far away. I thought the news was boring and had nothing to do with us. The decapitated mountains were not ours, nor were the children swept away by raging water. So I guess I'd pick that as my favorite passage.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I think that's a wonderful passage, and it really does kind of bridge, if this is, you know, sometime in the future, that passage absolutely bridges the present and the future, I think, in her own memory, but also just for us thinking forward.
That's 2084, you know, and not to... Yeah. Mr. Orwell.
Yeah. And so I came away with a kind of sense of urgency after reading this book, but also uncertainty about how to proceed. I don't know if you have thoughts about that.
I think that is the hard part. When I talk to young people, which I still do, they feel that they have that sense of urgency. They have a sense of fear. They're grappling with feelings of grief and anger, but they don't know what to do. And I do understand that, because it's such a big and worldwide problem that how do you get your arms around it? So I come down on what I said earlier, that movement, it's a mistake to think the world doesn't change. You know, I'm a female writer, I'm talking to a female professor, and in my lifetime, I almost couldn't marry who I wanted to, almost couldn't, you know, take out a bank loan. So it's a mistake to think the world doesn't change. It does change. But what brings that change about? And what brings that change about is energy among the people who are concerned, and organization, and good stories. And so what I say to the young people is what I said earlier that makes me an unwilling participant at a night out for a drink, is you have to talk to your friends, join with them. You know, help people who are active in any way that you can. If it's money, let's say you're a young mother and you have a young baby and really you can't, you know, be in the streets or whatever. If it's money, send money. If it's, you can make sandwiches, make sandwiches. If you can write, write. If you can help organize, organize. If you're willing to put your bodies in the streets, do that. I'm quite heartened by some of the civil protests that I've seen recently, especially the 1,000 or more scientists who demonstrated all over the world recently, because that's not what scientists do, eh? They're not in the street with placards. And I think perhaps as awful, as appalling as the war in the Ukraine is, maybe it'll make us understand our dependence on oil and gas, on fossil fuels that's actually destroying the entire planet.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems to be taking people a little while to get to that point, but yes. That seems to be the obvious conclusion.
It's the old boiling frog thing. You know, we react quickly to immediate threats, you know, the sort of genetic code that we have of the large animal. We react quickly to run away from an immediate threat, but a more slow moving one, we're just very bad at, you know. And especially a slow-moving, complex one, which is why I so feel that stories can help. Because if we ask each other to imagine what this really means, then I think we have our best chance of that imagination being the thing that motivates us to act in whatever way feels appropriate for us, feels possible for us.
Yeah. I have taken up so much of your time. I really want to thank you. I have one last question. Who are your ideal readers?
My ideal readers. First and foremost, people in the Caribbean or other island people. Because especially if you're a small island developing state, you get left out of the discussion about what we should do at this point. In my environmental life, I went a couple of times to these large either UN or other kinds of big international groupings meetings. And, you know, I noticed the delegation for a developed country, a Western country, would be 25 people, you know, but an island country would have one person or two or three. So it was really this power imbalance that I saw playing out in these big international meetings. So I want those of us who live on islands and where I am from, the Caribbean, to really imagine what this could mean for our lives. And then secondarily, we have a lot of people that visit our islands. They come as tourists. And I want to reach out to them as well and say, look, this isn't a playground for you.
Yeah.
This is a real place with real people who have real lives. And the lifestyle that has brought you here, the privilege that has brought you here to get on an airplane or a cruise ship and stay in a hotel, that privilege is threatening us. It's threatening us imminently.
Yeah.
So I don't want only to write to the Caribbean, although that's where I start always. I want to talk to the people who come to the Caribbean, people who love the idea of islands. Have you ever noticed what a romantic thought an island is for human beings? Often?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They love them, but they don't understand often the implications of what that means, right?
And I had a Peace Corps volunteer work for the Jamaica Environment Trust for 3 years once, and she said to me, and she was a very experienced American, 2 master's degrees, lots of experience in education, and she said to me, Jamaica is all the problems of the world writ small on a scale that you can manage. Mm-hmm. And I feel that about islands. I feel that they are the places where the solutions might be worked out, the places where the problems and the solutions are evident, are manifest on a scale that is manageable. And for that, they're valuable.
Yeah, I hope that's true. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, thank you, Alejandra. It was my pleasure.